Random House Audio presents Gone Tomorrow by Lee Child, read for you by Dick Hill. For my sisters-in-law, Leslie and Sally, two women of rare charm and quality. Chapter 1. Suicide bombers are easy to spot. They give out all kinds of telltale signs, mostly because they're nervous. By definition, they're all first-timers. Israeli counterintelligence wrote the defensive playbook. They told us what to look for. They used pragmatic observation and psychological insight and came up with a list of behavioral indicators. I learned the list from an Israeli army captain 20 years ago. He swore by it. Therefore, I swore by it, too, because at the time I was on 3 weeks detached duty, mostly about a yard from his shoulder, in Israel itself, in Jerusalem, on the West Bank, in Lebanon, sometimes in Syria, sometimes in Jordan, on buses, in stores, on crowded sidewalks. I kept my eyes moving and my mind running free down the bullet points. 20 years later, I still know the list, and my eyes still move. Pure habit. From another bunch of guys, I learned another mantra. Look, don't see. Listen, don't hear. The more you engage, the longer you survive. The list is 12 points long if you're looking at a male suspect, 11 if you're looking at a woman. The difference is a fresh shave. Male bombers take off their beards. It helps them blend in, makes them less suspicious. The result is paler skin on the lower half of the face, no recent exposure to the sun. But I wasn't interested in shaves. I was working on the 11-point list. I was looking at a woman. I was riding the subway in New York City, the 6th train, the Lexington Avenue local, heading uptown 2 o'clock in the morning. I had gotten on at Bleecker Street from the south end of the platform into a car that was empty except for 5 people. Subway cars feel small and intimate when they're full. When they're empty, they feel vast and cavernous and lonely. At night, their lights feel hotter and brighter, even though they're the same lights they use in the day. They're all the lights there are. I was sprawled on a 2-person bench north of the end doors on the track side of the car. The other 5 passengers were all south of me on the long bench seats, in profile, side on, far from each other, staring blankly across the width of the car, 3 on the left and 2 on the right. The car's number was 7622. I once rode 8 stops on the 6 train next to a crazy person who talked about the car we were in with the same kind of enthusiasm that most men reserve for sports or women. Therefore, I knew that car number 7622 was an R142A model, the newest on the New York system, built by Kawasaki in Kobe, Japan, shipped over, trucked to the 207th Street yards, craned onto the tracks, towed down to 180th Street, and tested. I knew it could run 200,000 miles without major attention. I knew its automated announcement system gave instructions in a man's voice and information in a woman's, which was claimed to be a coincidence, but was really because the transportation chiefs believed such a division of labor was psychologically compelling. I knew the voices came from Bloomberg TV, but years before Mike became mayor. I knew there were 600 R-142As on the tracks, and that each one was a fraction over 51 feet long and a little more than 8 feet wide. I knew that the no-cab unit like we had been in then, and I was in now, had been designed to carry a maximum of 40 people seated and up to 148 standing. The crazy person had been clear on all that data. I could see for myself that the car's seats were blue plastic, the same shade as a late summer sky or a British Air Force uniform. I could see that its wall panels were molded from graffiti-resistant fiberglass. I could see its twin strips of advertisements running away from me where the wall panels met the roof. I could see small, cheerful posters touting television shows and language instruction and easy college degrees and major earning opportunities. I could see a police notice advising me, "If you see something, say something." The nearest passenger to me was a Hispanic woman. She was across the car from me, on my left, forward of the first set of doors, all alone on a bench built for eight, well off center. She was small, somewhere between 30 and 50, and she looked very hot and very tired. She had a well-worn supermarket bag looped over her wrist, and she was staring across at the empty place opposite with eyes too weary to be seeing much. Next up was a man on the other side, maybe 4 feet farther down the car. He was all alone on his own eight-person bench. He could have been from the Balkans or the Black Sea. Dark hair, lined skin. He was sinewy, worn down by work and weather. He had his feet planted, and he was leaning forward with his elbows on his knees. Not asleep, but close to it. Suspended animation, marking time, rocking with the movements of the train. He was about 50, dressed in clothes far too young for him, baggy jeans that reached only his calves, and an oversized NBA shirt with a player's name on it that I didn't recognize. Third up was a woman who might have been West African. She was on the left, south of the center doors. Tired, inert, her black skin made dusty and gray by fatigue and the lights. She was wearing a colorful batik dress with a matching square of cloth tied over her hair. Her eyes were closed. I know New York reasonably well. I call myself a citizen of the world, and New York the capital of the world, so I can make sense of the city the same way a Brit knows London or a Frenchman knows Paris. I'm familiar but not intimate with its habits. But it was an easy guess that any three people like these, already seated on a late-night northbound 6 train south of Bleecker, were office cleaners heading home from evening shifts around City Hall, or restaurant service workers from Chinatown or Little Italy. They were probably set for Hunts Point in the Bronx, or maybe all the way up to Pelham Bay, ready for short, fitful sleeps before more long days. The fourth and the fifth passengers were different. The fifth was a man. He was maybe my age, wedged at 45 degrees on the two-person bench diagonally opposite me, all the way across and down the length of the car. He was dressed casually, but not cheaply. Chinos and a golf shirt. He was awake. His eyes were fixed somewhere in front of him. Their focus changed and narrowed constantly, like he was alert and speculating. They reminded me of a ballplayer's eyes. They had a certain canny, calculating shrewdness in them.